when he was at the printer, when a lot of that went on. At that point. Yes. Somebody else. Yes. Well, that was writing. Yeah, he wrote by typing, and sometimes by longhand. So he's got a big manuscript. What? Ah, yes. Who said that? Somebody practical. So he then, okay, financing. So how does he get money? He goes to Delhi and he tries to approach people and show them the manuscript that he wants to produce into a book. In that way he went to Hanuman Padar and showed him a big stack of papers, my Srimad Bhagavatam, and or tell people about it. And then, bit by bit, the donations come in. And he didn't even have to have the whole thing for the printer to begin by the Indian system at that time, very liberal. So, then he has money. Now, the next step, if we ask this in the West, no one would imagine that the author had to be involved in such a step. But there's another step that came after he had money, and so he was going to approach the printing stage. What was another thing he had to do? Yes? He had to buy the paper. So that's a very unusual task. He had to pick out the paper, buy the paper, everything but actually carry it on his back. But he had to hire the man who carried it on his back. And then he had, for the first volume, he had a printer's agent, Hitsaran Sharma. And then there was a printer, OK Press, who printed it. So Prabhupada typed the pages, and he gave it to his agent, who gave it to the printer. Then when it got printed, what's another... next step. Yes. Yeah, then he would proofread it. These big sheets would come out, and this time, then the work would get intense. Prabhupada would be staying at Chippewad, and the printer was a walk away, a good walk, through this very congested, busy area of Old Delhi. The Prabhupada would get the sheets, and then he would read them and see mistakes, and then he would correct them and give them back to the printer. And then what would happen? That was that it? Prabhupada just sat back and waited for the book? Yes? Again, they would do a few more sheets, and again he would look at it and make corrections. So that means he had to read the whole thing over and over. Although he was so old. And then he would give it to the printer, and they would do the rest. But when we did the research for the biography, we went and saw the places where it gets done. And you know, in India, everything is labor intensive. There's a man who does it, not a machine. And we saw how they put the pages together, how they bind the book. And it's really incredible how this... there was almost no electric machinery. Everything was being glued and punched and stepped on and folded over. And but somehow or other, it was getting done by all these different workers. So although Prabhupada, he wouldn't sit down with them with the jar of glue and this and that, but he would go there and he would look at different things. There's that famous line that he would go to the printer or the printer's agent and say, you told me it would be done, you've wasted my whole day. And in his memoirs, that man said he was angry. So Prabhupada wanted to get the Bhagavatam out. He was involved in all these steps. A modern publisher has many, many people doing all these things, proofreading, copy editing, and everything. But Prabhupada did it himself. So we have copies of the book. This is from the museum downstairs. They let me have it for a little while. And this wasn't also like done by Macmillan's artist, a book publisher. But Prabhupada, he contacted an artist and he told him what he wanted done, and the artist did this book cover. So he was involved in that too. It's like the color of a brick. Wonderful book. This is volume one. I could pass it around as long as it comes back. You can just touch the holy book. And I have another one too. Don't start reading it. Just kind of smell it and put it on your head and feel it. And give it back. I'd like to read from a purport where Prabhupada explains the mistakes, because although he proofread it, it had many mistakes. Many printing mistakes and many mistakes in grammar, spelling, and so on. So Prabhupada admits that that English is not his first language and that there are going to be so many mistakes. But he explains this to the reader in Bhagavatam 1.5.11 purport. We know that our attempt to present this great literature conveying transcendental messages for reviving the God consciousness of the people is fraught with many difficulties. Our presenting this matter in adequate language, especially a foreign language, will certainly fail, and there will be so many literary discrepancies, despite our honest attempt to present it in the proper way. But we are sure that with all our faults in this connection, the seriousness of the subject matter will be taken into consideration and will be accepted as an honest attempt to glorify the Almighty God. After all, it is the technical science of spiritual values, and we are concerned with the techniques, not with the language. So, what feelings are come to you by hearing this appeal of Prabhupada? How does it make you respond when you read this? Anyone? When you just heard it now, or when you've read it before? Yes? You get the impression that this person, author, Prabhupada, is very genuine in wanting us to take to Krishna consciousness. Jaya Dwaita Maharaj told me that in his editing class, you discussed Prabhupada as a writer. So somebody asked him what he was pointing out so many faults in writing, and someone said, well, what do you think of Prabhupada's writing? He said one answer he gave was that when you read his writing, you can see this is a person who has something very important to say in a language that's not his own, he was saying. So that's kind of what you're touching on, that the genuineness of what he is saying is comes through. And he gives the example that if there's a fire in a house and you don't speak the language of the people in there, you'll somehow make yourself understood because of the urgency, and they'll get out. All right, what else? Maru?
His Highness is wanting to communicate with us in our language, and he apologizes for his presentation, whereas actually you could say that the English is the imperfect language, the Sanskrit is the perfect language of the science of God, but he's making the reader feel comfortable to begin to approach it in his own language. He apologizes for his presentation.
Although Prabhupada is more the scholar and the teacher than we are, he takes a humble position and apologizes. So this wins us over, I think. As he says, at least an honest person will be won over and even charmed by this kind of presentation, and will be willing to overlook so many mistakes. I know when I read it in 1966, it was like a reading adventure. It was interesting. I've never seen such a book like that. And even the mistakes, it just made it somehow more mystical. And partly it was because Prabhupada was very upfront. He said, in effect, that you've probably never seen a book like this with so many mistakes. But please accept it. It's very important, what I have to say. It's more, I couldn't wait. And so you say, yes, I want to see what is so important. And this person is so sincere that these mistakes are not important. It almost has the flavor of some daring literary innovator who breaks rules and, you know, writes words down the middle of the page or something, and that he's doing what he has to do and the rules become unimportant. But Prabhupada also broke all the rules. But it is appealing to us, his apology. And of course he's got a Srimad Bhagavatam verse, not just his purport, which backs that up and says that even if this literature is presented with mistakes, it is appreciated by those who are thoroughly honest. Whereas works that may be perfect according to grammar and ornaments of language, if they don't glorify God, they have no value. They're like the garbage sought after by crows. So that was not only Prabhupada's apology, but Vyasadeva backed him up. Jagadish Maharaj has sometimes explained that verse to say that it was actually, it's like a prophecy in the Srimad Bhagavatam of Srila Prabhupada. Not just the factor that it's there's some imperfect, but the verse also says, even though imperfect, this work will create a revolution in the impious civilization. That's a nice analysis. Any other responses to that disclaimer or apology? Yes? Yeah. You appreciate the man. We don't think of Prabhupada as a man, but just say like an outsider. You'd appreciate this man that is pushing on this, so many difficulties, getting his book out. So then, it was done. And then Prabhupada immediately went back to Vrindavan to do the next volume. He was just like making a chain reaction that whatever money he got from selling some first books, he would put into the second book. And so he had to finish it. So he wrote it quickly. And this was like a kind of a marathon of writing. So this brings up an application question. Can anyone give an example of intense endeavors with a deadline that devotees of Prabhupada have engaged in? And can you say what it's like? And now, what's that much? Yeah. Oh, you
ordered 1975 to all 17 volumes.
Yeah. We'll be talking about that when we get to it. So that Prabhupada himself continued that, passed it on to others. When he asked them to publish 17 books in 2 months, but he knew what it was like to push himself to finish his Bhagavatam writing. That's a history, but each of us have also been involved at certain times working like that, pushing ourselves with some deadline of service, like book distribution marathon, Prabhupada marathon. And when we do that, we can get a little idea of how it was for Prabhupada, who also worked like that. And this was one time he did. In fact, book distributors have meditated like that, that as he worked so hard to write it, then I must distribute it. In the Prabhupada Lilamrita, we have at length another brilliant explanation by Prabhupada. It's on pages 270 to 72. It appeared as the preface to volume 2, and now it's gone. It's not in any of the BBTs that are published now. They don't have it, but it's in the Prabhupada Lilamrita. And I touched on it a little already, but I want to make some comments about it. He refers to they, meaning some people who might criticize him, and say that he has become a businessman in the dress of a mendicant. And therefore you see him in the printing capital of India buying paper and arguing with the printer. So somebody might say, criticize. And actually they did criticize. When Prabhupada later was in Bombay, staying at the Prem Kutir, he mentioned that somebody criticized him that although he's a sannyasi, he's always selling his books and looks like a businessman. Sannyasis don't do this. So in this preface to volume 2, which is in SPL, Prabhupada justifies his actions on the principle of yukta vairagya. It can be done, and it can continue to be done. In terms of sannyas, I remember when we just formed the library party in America, I asked Prabhupada if I could give up sannyas dress to go around to the libraries. Yes, he said right away, whatever you have to do. So even this, Prabhupada didn't give up sannyas dress, but even that can be done for preaching, although someone may misunderstand. And then in this essay, Prabhupada talks about there's no donors. That's why I'm here begging you, because nobody's donating for this. I'm doing all this work. But formerly, it used to be that rich people would be very happy to do the pious work of donating a Bhagavatam. Before there was printing, there's an injunction in the scriptures that if you write out a Bhagavatam and give it as a gift to someone at a certain time of the year in a certain box, that you get a tremendous spiritual reward. So where is that spirit now? He said, I recently asked an industrialist to take 100 copies to give out to his workers, but the poor fellow expressed his inability. So Prabhupada is making a practical request for money to print his books, but justifying himself too. And he's confident that he's not getting contaminated by this mixing in the world, by this begging and selling and printing. But he says he will transcend and get through to the invincible impasse of Maya and reach the kingdom of God and render face-to-face service to God. The reader will gain this too by hearing the glories of the Lord. I don't think any of us have any shadow of doubt like that, but I'll give you some Shastric evidence on it too. There's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the example is given of Mukundan, who was a physician, and yet he was a pure devotee. And this is in Madhya Lila 15, 119 through 130. In one purport, Prabhupada says, a Vaishnava may be engaged in governmental service or in a professional business, so that externally one cannot understand his position. Internally, however, he may be a Nitya Siddha Vaishnava, eternally liberated. So we've described the first Bhagavatams, and this work now became a very distinct daily feature of Prabhupada's life right up until the end. The last weeks, wherever he was, he worked on the Bhagavatam. He managed to carry with him several books that were needed, including the commentaries of the previous acharyas and dictionaries that he required. Gradually it turned into not typing by him, but dictating machines. Any meditation on Prabhupada certainly must include this phase of his life. It's very sweet how he gets up early in the morning and talks into the dictaphone. I often tell devotees that if you feel that you want a personal relationship with Prabhupada, you can read his books, because they were spoken in the quiet of the night, with nobody in the room. Wasn't a big thing of many, many people. And so you can just like be there with him as he's talking to Krishna, as he's speaking his purports. He called this work his personal ecstasy. Any questions? Yes. Well, he sold it to whoever would buy it, but there was an English-speaking market in India then, so he went to libraries to sort out the English-speaking market. universities and libraries. For example, he was very proud of the fact that through the American embassy, he got the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. to agree to take 18 copies of every volume. And that was part of some deal of exchange America had with India. It was part of that program, so they accepted. And still, those books can be found in America through that work. Yes, but it turned out to be not profitable. He could we have an interview with one bookseller. He said he did a rather brisk business. He sold about 100 books, but he said it's, from his point of view, it's not a popular item, a religious book in English. So it wasn't a money maker for Prabhupada. He wasn't going to get rich on the Bhagavatams. So the idea of it financing him for America, it didn't work out, so that when it was time to go, he didn't even have the fare, not even boat fare. Yes? Yeah, but I don't remember. It's either in the book or it's in the biography. I don't remember. Yes?
English writing. And the devotee fought to improve his English at a certain moment, but had the devotee discussed with Prabhupada what it was the place to rewrite the books with English.
I'm not sure of your question. Are you saying, did Prabhupada's English improve, or did the devotees suggest to him that it ought to improve?
Some English-speaking devotee would have corrected Prabhupada.
If he had somebody working with him?
Yeah, if Prabhupada thought at a certain stage that some of his
disciples
would have...
Well, that happened. When he came to America. But in India, there was nobody that he had to work with. But he was very happy that one of his first disciples was an English professor who would teach students grammar and who could professionally edit. Professor Howard Wheeler became Hari Griva, and he was the first editor. And then eventually Jaya Dwaita Maharaj. So, yeah, that was a boon for Prabhupada. Prabhupada's books are well edited. Now they're not at all like that one. They're polished, presentable, scholarly books. One devotee, there's a letter correspondence, a devotee in the BBT in Germany in the late 1960s, I think. They had some argument in their BBT. One devotee said, let's just get the books out fast like Prabhupada did, even if it has mistakes in it. And the other was, he was going slow. He wanted to make everything perfect. So they wrote to Prabhupada about it. They said, all right to publish your books with mistakes. You did that. And I can't quote it exactly, but he said something like, but I have also created the Hare Krishna movement and spread this movement around the world. If you can do that, then you can print books with mistakes. Which is what Prabhupada did in the beginning. He said, but now there should be no mistakes. It is a great embarrassment for us. And he was just the opposite spirit later. He would get disturbed if there was any mistake at all. So that, as we cite examples and imitation, that would be a terrible imitation and like an offense to say, well, it was really nice. Prabhupada printed it up with all the mistakes. We do too. But he didn't want any mistakes. You hear even some lectures, they read the Bhagavatam and they read the synonyms. He says, what is that? Oh, that should not be. This is not good. This is very bad. If he sees some little mistake, in the editing or printing. Good point to raise. All right then, I'll let you go. Yeah, please return Srimad Bhagavatam right now. Yesterday, I got a nice batch of questions, so I'll go over them. I went over them, prepared some answers. and looking forward to more, getting more today that we can do tomorrow. You mentioned that some of Srila Prabhupada's sons were demoniac. And there is another example of a great Vaishnavacharya having all Mayavadi sons but one. In the light of this, what are realistic expectations for our children? What are the factors? What are the factors in raising Krishna conscious children? Is the role of Prabhupada's children part of his Leela, like Jai and Vijay, Hiranyakashipu, etc.? So what does it, how do we understand this? That a pure devotee had children who were not pure devotees, not even devotees. One thing it shows is the free will of the living entity, and it also shows that even if your parents are pure devotees, you may still be subject to Maya. I have the example of Kala Krishnadas, who traveled as a personal associate of Lord Chaitanya and fell into Maya. So even when you're personally with the Lord, you still have this ability to become overcome by Maya if you don't take advantage. So these are great opportunities to be born of such a pure devotee, but they can be lost. Also, as far as the Leela of the pure devotee, it shows that the seminal line of sons and daughters of a pure devotee isn't as important as the line of disciples, his spiritual sons and daughters. It can be that one can see the parents as spiritual preceptors. But just because they're children of the pure devotee doesn't mean that that they'll be so appreciative. Whereas the spiritual sons and daughters are more important. This is pointed out in different other examples. The followers of Lord Nityananda, the claims of the seminal line of children from Lord Nityananda to be caste Goswamis, Prabhupada said, this is not the line. The line is spiritual. And even that doesn't mean everyone who is listed on the list of persons who are initiated, but those who actually carry the line, whoever they may be. Sons, daughters, or not sons and daughters. Once Prabhupada was asked the question, I remember, are you happy? So Prabhupada said, I have many levels of happiness. And then he gave an example, which was like one that the person could understand. He said, before I became a sannyasi, I had so many sons and daughters, but they were a burden to me. Now I have many more sons and daughters, but they are helping me in so many ways. So this is happiness, he said. Anyone like to volunteer any other suggestions about this? How to take this? Yes. Kali Pani. Was not. Which is a way to explain things. Yes, she even turned them against their father, giving them tea when he said no. Yes.
I always think of it in terms of how universal and powerful problem really was that he came in such a situation that dealt with the disciples that were not very qualified, so he changed the whole world.
What's that have to do with his children?
Oh.
Yeah.
Despite all these circumstances, it didn't at all deter him.
Good. Yes.
If there were sort of more devotees than the booster gets. Almost devotion can be because they're obviously off.
If they were more like devotees, they might have been even more of a disturbance than the fact that they weren't at all. How might they be more of a disturbance?
Because we accept the devotees from as children, even though they were acquired.
They may have taught something devious and claimed followers, or so on. No one will listen to them now.
But that reason, Krishna,
yeah. You had something?
I was just going to say,
like his wife that he wasn't attracted to. That may not answer your question so much about what chance do we have to raise our children. We've mostly explained it in terms of Prabhupada. But these examples of great, great personalities, as we've heard now, they have very extraordinary things being worked out in Prabhupada's life, which doesn't apply in our case in so many ways. So don't become overwhelmed by the fact that he didn't produce children who were Krishna conscious. It doesn't have so much bearing that should make us despair. Sometimes we hear that Lord Brahma falls into Maya, and we say, well, if he falls into Maya, then what are my chances? But it's an example that should make us not helpless, but think, I have to be very careful. But there are examples of people who have raised Krishna conscious children, and we have to who are followers of Prabhupada, and we'll have to use their example and just take it as our duty. I don't know what any other way to look. There may be some other ideas, but don't be overwhelmed by that. What happened in Prabhupada's life. Yes? Yeah, so to some degree you do have to see that even in his family it wasn't pure devotees, so don't be so attached that your son is another great soul. That he must turn out in a certain way, she must turn out in a certain way, then that will produce strife. It'll be mixed. Your spiritual desires will be mixed with the fact that there's, even in your devotee family, there's still the old familial strife between parents and growing up children, and they won't like it. They'll first get away from you, and then they'll become a devotee. Even though you're a devotee, but you're their mother. Like Prabhupada said, once he was sitting with some friends, and his son walked in and sat on his body. And one of the men said, well, you should not do this. You put your feet on the body of a Vaishnava. And the boy said, what Vaishnava? He's my father. Okay, here's another one. Did Srila Prabhupada ever mention why he preferred to always cook for himself? Why didn't he just take the temple deity prasadam? This could have particularly applied to when he was living in Vrindavan. So it's the Brahminical standard that a Brahmin cook for himself. Prabhupada, as a child, said he used to go on the street and watch Brahmins cooking. He said each one would have a little cooking setup. And that's how he learned to cook kachoris, by watching. So if you cook for yourself, you know it's pure, clean. You know it's offered with devotion. Not by somebody who's smoking cigarettes or eating fish or who knows what's going on. That's another reason. And also, Prabhupada had a simpler diet. He didn't eat a lot of fried foods and so on. When he was in a situation where he had his disciples who did things the way he wanted, then he didn't persist in cooking, although he would sometimes cook. The same person asked, when did he learn to type? I don't know exactly when. Maybe in college, but I know at least when he was typing. He was typing in the 1950s. It's a little fact that I don't know about how he learned to type. Yes? Shouldn't touch fire? There are so many rules. You want to answer that? Prabhupada was not cooking for himself, he was cooking for Krishna. So the pure devotee overrules the sannyasi. Prabhupada, in the Bhagavad Gita also, Krishna says, he who gives up the fruit of his acts, he's a sannyasi, not he who lights no fire. And Prabhupada explains, lights no fire means the sannyasis, they don't cook. There are a lot of things we'll see when Prabhupada went to New York that he did that sannyasis may not be, they're not supposed to cross the ocean, they're not supposed to do this or that. And he lived in situations where he said, either I give up the preaching or not follow this rule. So, another one? These two different moods, the chopping technique of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and his preaching, and another one, which is described by Prabhananda Saraswati Thakur, that you should flatter people and be very humble before them. They appear to be different. This is more a comment. But it appears that they would have the same goal, which is to preach or spread the mission that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami gave to Prabhupada. So following the spirit of the spiritual master seems to be the real point, not just to follow the letter or the literal statement or example. Is this the right way to look at things? Yes, I think it is. It's a good explanation for applying all of Prabhupada's activities in our lives, that we should follow the spirit of them, not always that we have to do it exactly the way he did it. That may be very very foolish and counterproductive in some cases, because he was always acting in a particular time and place. An unintelligent follower just imitates what he did without knowing what the purpose was. In the last class, it was mentioned how Srila Prabhupada kept careful account of even the smallest expenditure while living in Vrindavan. I remember reading how he was doing this in New York also. Not wasting anything. My question is, should we keep accounts as Prabhupada did on an individual basis, or would this be an imitation? If you have individual money, and you're a devotee, then certainly you should be very careful about it. Don't waste Krishna's money. Don't waste anything of Krishna's. Of course, if we're part of a temple, there are many instructions about that from Prabhupada, how they should keep very careful accounts. And legally, you're obliged to do that, especially if you receive any kind of donations from the public. But so on every level, in a similar way, I would say, yes, an individual should do like Prabhupada and keep account of it, income and expenditures. That was his mood. Some more? Wow, using up our time. Maybe since I didn't get any new ones today, I'll save these for tomorrow. But you can see they're fun, so please keep them coming. This is called Journey to America. Sometimes devotees say that Rupa Goswami, in his presence at Radha Damodar Temple, and also Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur, ordered or inspired Srila Prabhupada to go west. So what is the evidence that this statement is true, that it happened in that way? Anyone have a reply to that? That Rupa Goswami inspired Prabhupada to go? To leave Vrindavan and go to the west? Probably it's hard to answer, because if we think of something very specific and mystical, we don't want to speculate. There's that nice picture that was that accompanied Mahanidhi Swami's Vyas Pujamaj a year ago, where Prabhupada is in the kitchen of his still existing Radha Damodar room. He's eating, and Mahanidhi Swami in his essay calls our attention to the window, and you see the sunlight is pouring in. And so he has poetically taken it that this is like the Shakti of Rupa Goswami, and Prabhupada is looking out the window and the sun is coming in, as if he's being empowered at that moment, and every time he sat there. So we assume that a kind of communication was going on, a deep communication. But what can we say about some conversations or anything like that? So then we may have to drop to some more tangible evidence, but very strong evidence. So Srila Prabhupada said that his spiritual master was always with him, and always seeing his activities and guiding him. So as far as Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur. Then you have any statement that's been made by the acharyas or scriptures ordering the devotee to take this message out of India. Can anyone think of statements like that from the shastras? Yes. Right. Yeah, that's the most famous. From the Chaitanya Bhagavat, Lord Chaitanya said that my name will be known in every town and village of the world. That's an order. And another one, equally famous, Bharati Bhumite Anusya Janma Jara Janma Sartika Kari Karapara Upakar. Anyone born in Bharat Varsha has the duty to help other people by telling them about Krishna. So these are prophetic statements and orders. So these are orders that he should go out. Yes? Bhaktivinoda Thakur made similar predictions. So the inspiration is there. Even today, we can get inspired by things that Prabhupada says in his lectures to a whole group. Perhaps we weren't present at the time, but we can hear it, and the inspiration still holds. Or we can read a letter that he wrote to someone and feel, yeah, this, I'm inspired by what Prabhupada said. I'm going to do that. He wanted that. So inspiration is certainly there. Rupa Goswami himself, as Prabhupada gives it in the Nectar Devotion, defines Krishna consciousness as auspicious. And the definition he gives is wide distribution of Krishna consciousness. So here, that's another order by Rupa Goswami. Rupa Goswami's master, Lord Chaitanya, predicted that his name would be heard in every town in the world. But most important, there was the direct order by Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur, and that we've discussed. So, to conclude this idea of Rupa Goswami ordering Prabhupada to leave Vrindavan, actually Prabhupada's whole life was a preparation to do this. Not that it happened only when he came to the Radha Damodar Temple, but the Radha Damodar Temple was a source of inspiration because of the residents, the samadhis, previous residents, and continual residents of Jiva Goswami and Rupa Goswami, Prabhupada. And our Prabhupada has said that too. Things like that. I started out by saying that devotees say this, we hear it. So I was saying, what is the evidence for it? It's a common mode of expression that he was in Vrindavan and Rupa Goswami ordered him to go to the west. Now let's consider the events leading up to his departure from India. There were so many things he had to do to get patronage from America and passage fare and so on. So are these external events? In a sense, yes. The internal event is the order that we've just discussed, the order of his spiritual master and the acharyas. So these other things, we'll discuss them. We're interested in them, even if we call them external. This is the filling out of the story, of the adventure, which what makes it Prabhupada Leela. So Prabhupada and Nugas are eager to hear how it came about. Another reason, not only that they find it exciting, but they want the world to appreciate how Prabhupada came to America against such difficulties. That's why it's nice to distribute this book, because then people can read how Prabhupada came, and they have admiration. He had nothing and he was all alone and he came. So we want them to hear the external difficulties. And Prabhupada himself later said, with what difficulty I got out of the country. And he himself would tell the story in a way to criticize the Indian government or Indian leaders for not sending him off, but making so many problems before he could get out. Now here's a question. Now that we're really coming to this moment of his departure, we're making some last considerations. But why didn't he go earlier? What about that question? Someone answer it? We've already mentioned some things. Yes. Why didn't Prabhupada go earlier? Yeah. He wanted to have books. He didn't want to go empty-handed. So yesterday we discussed that struggle and wonderful story, how he got the books. Now he had the books, so he didn't want to go empty-handed. That's one reason he didn't go earlier. Another, Ramana?
Time is right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a big thing. We'll talk about that when we start getting into Prabhupada in America. So he said the time was ready in the West. So I'd like to elaborate a little on that. This is partly, you could say, speculation, historical speculation, but there's a lot to it also. I say speculation because what if Prabhupada did go at some other time? We can't say that he wouldn't have been successful. But what we are trying to say is that Prabhupada didn't delay. He went when Krishna sent him, and he went, and Krishna sent him at the best time. So I don't think you call it speculation, except in the way that Prabhupada said that's allowable to appreciate Krishna in many ways. So in the 1940s, the climate in America, the world war was on, and the war was over, and everyone was very materialistically trying to put back their life together. People weren't interested in yoga and spiritual life. In the 1950s, they weren't either. But something happened, something extraordinary happened in America particularly, and then around the world in the 1960s, which we call the counterculture. If we just call it the hippie movement, that doesn't really explain it. There was something very deep. The whole country was affected. So I'm not going to go into the history of the counterculture, but what it produced was large sections of middle-aged youth who left their homes, left college careers, and went to city centers looking for, among other things, among nonsense that they were looking for, they were also looking for a spiritual life, gurus and so on, with a real, some of them were serious. So this was, this is one thing to consider, in the perfection of the timing. One devotee who was there at the time, Brahmananda Das, he's fascinated by this historical entry of the Krishna consciousness movement at the time it came. So he's done more research, you could call it like footnotes, just for interest. And in other words, he's looking for other facts that show that this was the real time for the Krishna conscious movement to come. He has two facts I thought were worth mentioning. One is that in the summer of 1966, the President of the United States signed a new Asian immigration law. Now, up to that year, the immigration was extremely restricted for Asians. I don't have the figures, but it was absurdly low. So many Asians were allowed per year. And then in a liberal mood, the president, and for some political reasons, he just opened the gates, and now many, many more Asians were allowed. So Prabhupada got in, and then he was able to stay and stay. He renewed his visa. So this is an interesting background of Krishna, the things Krishna did, we can say. Then another thing he put forward for consideration was the Catholic Church also underwent a very revolutionary change just around the time Prabhupada came. They held their meeting, which is called Vatican II. And up to that time, for many, many centuries, their doctrine was that anybody outside their church is going to hell, and they didn't give any respect to other religions. And then they had this big meeting, which was very upsetting for their conservatives, but they took this new stance that we have to face the world, we have to face that other religions are God-conscious. We know now even today the Catholics are like receptive to this point of view. So this may not have so much bearing on things, but Brahmananda has given it, I find it, these things are, they're like interesting tidbits. That Prabhupada entered the country at a time when they were like looking to show themselves that, yeah, we recognize yoga, we recognize Asian religions, and Thomas Merton wrote the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, and the young people who, if they had that background, they also may have been affected by this big change in the church. But the real thing is, on the historical level, is the counterculture. There's one statement by one of the leaders of the counterculture who visited the temple, Allen Ginsberg, and he has a brief description of the devotees that he saw there. Most of them were just like gentle folk, bearded, hip, and curious. They were refugees from the middle class in the Lower East Side, looking exactly like the street sadhus in India. It was very similar, that phase in American underground history, and I liked immediately the idea that Swami Bhaktivedanta had chosen the Lower East Side of New York for his practice. He'd gone to the lower depths. He'd gone to a spot more like the side streets of Calcutta than any other place. And that other statement by him, to choose to attend to the Lower East Side, what kindness and humility and intelligence. All right, so we've jumped ahead to look at what New York was like. Now we're back in India trying to get out. Externally, what did Prabhupada have to do to get out of India? Let's go over the external steps. I have a certain order in mind, although things did occur in an order, actually. So what was the first thing that happened that made him think, hey, here's the opportunity that I've been looking for? Yes. Yes, without doing anything, he just talked to somebody casually. All of a sudden, it came to him from America, we will sponsor you for 2 months. So he got sponsorship from the Agarwals. Then what else did he have to get? What? Yeah, but that came a little later. He had to have some other things first.
Passport.
Yeah, he didn't have a passport. So he had to get an Indian passport, and you're given something else. He had to get a visa. All right? Those who know the or read the book, or what are some other Indian technicalities that he needed? P-form. Also, no objection. No objection certificate had to come from the government. Then the P-form from the Bank of India. And that was almost like the last straw. He couldn't get the P-form, and then he... so dramatic how he finally... The man who normally judged such cases said, you can't get it. You only have a private sponsor. You should have an institution sponsor you. And Prabhupada said, no, this is not right. I must see your superior. Give the file to your superior. And he was waiting in the office, and the superior came out and said, it's all right, Swamiji, I passed your case. Now we have so many people, when we were interviewing for the biography, people were coming forward and said, I told him to go. I gave him the money to go. I'm the one who gave him the permission from the Bank of India. I'm the one who did this. But it doesn't line up with what Prabhupada said, with what difficulty I got out of the country. Then, as you say, he needed travel fare. So these are all the things. And there was one other thing that certainly he needed, that when we come to India, I don't think anyone would come without this, even if you had all these things. You had the passport, you had your fare to go there. Another external thing you would need. Yes? Fare money. Right. And something else? Yeah. Yeah, you need some spending money. How can you go to a country without some spending money? And so that he didn't have. And he went... Another sign of his bravery, that he went without any spending money. There's a quote by Prabhupada. Oh, I don't think I can find it so easily. It's I quoted at the beginning of a poem about his bravery. But I remember it. He was on a walk in Calcutta, and they were looking at the massive Victoria Memorial building. And Prabhupada commented, he said, when I was a boy, they were just building that. And I used to climb up on it, on the scaffolds. So one of the devotees said, Prabhupada, you were so brave. He said, of course I was brave. He said, how could I have come to America alone? And as we're about, with Prabhupada, to leave India, let's ask again, or raise that objection that someone might say, but a sadhu is not supposed to leave India. So what are the reasons that they say that a sadhu shouldn't leave India or cross the ocean? What are the injunctions? Why is that injunction there? There is some reason behind it. Yes?
Bad association.
Yeah, bad association outside of India with the various mlecha, yavana. So association is so important. If you want to protect your association, don't leave the land of religion and go to the other lands. That's basically it. Also, on the positive side, one stays in a holy dham like Vrindavan, hoping that if I die there, if I leave, I may die in some horrible place. But if I stay... When Prabhupada, in his very last days... You can see even then he didn't consider that. He went to England, and then when he was planning in Vrindavan, he said, I'll go to England and then I'll go to New York. He said, but if I die in New York, he said, then you can bury me on the roof of the skyscraper. He said, because there's no other room. But he wasn't afraid to leave Vrindavan even at the end. But they're afraid that what happens if I die, or I may get corrupted. But the reasons to go, as we've discussed, the order of the spiritual master and the acharyas, these are much stronger reasons to break those other reasons. Now, so Prabhupada got on the boat. Nobody saw him off, except one almost stranger. And we know about the boat journey because of the diary he kept. So I want to talk a little bit about the diary. It begins with a crisis in health, seasickness, he writes, dizziness, vomiting, Bay of Bengal, heavy rains, more sickness. Prabhupada writes in the quick noting down style of a diarist. He notes briefly their stop in Ceylon, and then again a terse but a grave recordings of his health. He says, rain, seasickness, dizziness, headache, no appetite, vomiting. The seasickness led to heart attacks, and on the third night of the attacks, Prabhupada had a vision of Krishna, who encouraged him to persevere. Then the diary records smoother times. September 13th, today I disclose my mind to my companion, Lord Sri Krishna. There is a Bengali poem made by me in this connection. I've had a lot of interest in diaries because I write a diary and I've also studied diaries. So there are even scholars of diaries. So people who study other people's diaries, they want to know, for whom was this diary written? Was there some particular audience in mind? Sometimes people, they write so that their daughter can read their diary 20 years from now, or they have somebody in mind. So we think about Prabhupada. In his diary, it appears that he's sometimes writing just for the sake of keeping a record of his voyage. Sometimes he speaks of the deities of Vrindavan, referring to them as their lordships. Sometimes he speaks to his spiritual master in the third person, he. But sometimes, especially in the poetry, Prabhupada is writing to Krishna, and the diary becomes very intimate. Today, remembrance of you came to me in a very nice way. Because I have a great longing, I call to you. I'm your eternal servant, and therefore I desire your association so much. O Lord Krishna, except for you, there is no means of success. The dream that Prabhupada had, that's not recorded in the diary, but he told it in conversations. After two consecutive nights of painful heart attacks, he thought, if it comes again, I'll die. And the dream was that Krishna in his many forms came rowing a boat and encouraging him. When we compiled the diary, the biography, I had excerpts of the diary, photostat, but I didn't have the whole thing. And I recently saw some more of it, and it was printed by Kaylee Lalita, who does this meditations, daily meditations and devotions, a monthly booklet that's distributed in ISKCON. And so here are some of the passages that I had never seen before, or I did, but not when the biography came out. They're really nice. Prabhupada gets a little more descriptive about things. At about dawn, there is a little lurching. The captain tells that they have never such calmness of the Atlantic. I said it is Lord Krishna's mercy. His wife asked me to come back again with them so that they may have again a calm Atlantic Ocean. If Atlantic would have shown its usual face, perhaps I would have died, but Lord Krishna has taken charge of the ship. And here's more descriptive. Sometimes we think the pure devotee is completely internal. He doesn't care anything about his surroundings or note anything down. But here is Prabhupada writing about the surroundings also. 34th day of our journey. As usual, I rise up at 3 a.m. and when I walked to veranda, I saw the sky almost clear. There was moonshine on head. And although the wind from southeast was strong, the ocean was clear visible and the ship was passing smoothly. At about 11 a.m., the sky again became overcast with cloud, and it continued to 3 p.m. There was rainfall at intervals, but after 4 o'clock, the sky became clear and there was bright sunshine. I was engaged in reading Kaliya Damodar Leela from Srimad Bhagavatam, especially the prayers by Srimati Nagapatnis and their last appealing prayers by Kaliya. Such an intimate view of Prabhupada. Makes you wish you were with him on the voyage. And then he describes 16th of September, 35th day of the voyage. We have turned one wheel towards northeastern corner of the Bermuda latitude. Sounds like a real mariner. towards Boston Port, In the morning, the atmosphere was fair and clear. The ship was plying very smoothly. The first officer told me that they never had such experience of the Atlantic Ocean, and he ascribed the good luck to me. I said, yes, it is all Lord Krishna's grace, because due to my severe type of seasickness, he himself has taken charge of the ship. In an expansion, the Lord is rowing the oars. So here's another. Prabhupada just says he told this to the captain, but he actually had a direct vision of this. We shall certainly reach to America port safely. Any comments about the diary so far? So he said that he wrote a poem at sea, and we have it. So you've read it. And I just wanted to mention some of the features. One is the confidential tone of his inner life. This is our original theme from the first class, the two lives of the spiritual master, and we see them together. We see the Prabhupada preacher in an intense preaching situation, traveling to America, and yet at the same time he's speaking of his eternal relationship with Radha and Krishna. It starts out with an address to Radharani. I emphatically say to you, O brothers, you will obtain your good fortune from the Supreme Lord only when Srimati Radharani becomes pleased with you. So that's another point, that we must please Radharani. Earlier in the diary, he spoke of separation from Vrindavan. Another point in the poem, it's called translated as the lotus feet of prayer to the lotus feet of Krishna. He recognizes Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur as the one guru by whose desire the holy name will spread. Very confident tone for somebody who is having heart attacks and is going on such a fearful type of journey. He speaks of his eternal intimate relationship with Krishna. Regarding that confident attitude, even if we look at the poem and the diary from a psychological point of view, these are the expressions of a person who is convinced that a higher destiny is working through him. And therefore, he's sure, I'm going to have influence when I go there. Even if somebody wasn't a devotee and they read this, they'd say, wow, this person is really convinced and not from any ordinary, for any ordinary reasons. He's got a strong confidence that he's going to succeed. And they would say, psychologically, that this contributed to the fact that he did succeed. He had such a positive thinking and such determination that, yeah, something's going to happen through me. For us reading the poems now, they're important evidence that Prabhupada was the eternal associate of the Lord in Goloka Vrindavan, come down to deliver the souls in Kali Yuga. When we were looking for evidence of Prabhupada's second life, this would be an important place, statements by him to this effect in the diary. He was also, therefore, the eternal associate of Lord Chaitanya and the eternal servant of his spiritual master, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Then when he arrived in Boston, he wrote another poem. And this poem reveals the elements which Prabhupada possessed that would make him successful in his mission. He had a simple program, delivering the holy name, chanting Hare Krishna mantra, and delivering the message of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam without change. Because of his deep faith in these things and his dependence on Krishna, as expressed in this poem, he was successful. I've also outlined some main elements of the poem. I numbered the verses. Well, they're not numbered in the book, where it says it's on 281 in your little appendix. Markine Bhagavata Dharma. So where it says translation, I put 1, the next translation 2. So this poem is important for us today, that we try to have some of the determination Prabhupada did, our founder Acharya, for what we have to do facing the obstacles we face. So one element which is his helpless his expression of helpless feelings. This is in, you can find this in verse 1, verse 2, and verse 11. You could say, well, this is Prabhupada's lila, that he felt like almost scared or so helpless. What's going to happen? But it's a lila, but if we want to worship and be close to Prabhupada, we should feel the mood and believe that he really felt this way. He wasn't just saying it, so that writing it down so that people later would be humble. I'll write something humble so later people will be humble. That would be artificial. He felt like this. Oh, my dear Lord Krishna, you are so kind upon this useless soul, but I do not know why you have brought me here. Now you can do whatever you like with me. I guess you have some business here. Otherwise, why would you bring me to this terrible place? And in 11, how will I make them understand this message of Krishna consciousness? I am very unfortunate, unqualified, and the most fallen. And another element is a very personal quality of the writing. It's not an official piece stating the dogma, or just to write a literary exercise. Let me write I have some time to kill in the Boston port. Let me try to write a rhyming Bengali poem, something to do. But he was writing very personally. And he amazes us with the intimacy he has with Krishna. This you can see in verses 4 and 5. I know your causeless mercy can make everything possible because you are the most expert. I'm simply praying for your mercy, so that I will be able to convince them about your message. He asks Krishna why he has sent him here and how he expects him to succeed. And then, although he's feeling although he's feeling helpless, as the poem develops, courage comes. Where does the courage come from? In the poem, where does he get inspiration and courage? Somebody say, yes. He remembers, first he's thinking, what will I do? You must have sent me here for some purpose, but these people are so demoniac, what will I do? And then, oh, I remember, the Srimad Bhagavatam says that if you preach and people hear, the knots of their attachment will be broken and they'll become liberated. I believe in these words of Srimad Bhagavatam, so if I deliver this message, even though to my senses today this place looks horrible and I feel a little overwhelmed, the Srimad Bhagavatam will do the job. And then he makes a plea and expresses confidence in Krishna. Make me dance, make me dance. And he ends with more humility, describing himself as insignificant beggar, but externally speaking it's also accurate statement. That's the way he was seen by Americans. So we've come to the point of Prabhupada arriving in America and writing these poems. Any questions? Yes.
Yes, in regard to the question you were asking about why the Prabhupada choose to come dead, it seems that he was trying in whatever way he could to execute the order of spiritual masters in such a dependent position from the spiritual Brahman and Krishna. And he just kind of followed the leads that Krishna opened up for him. It wasn't that there was so much choice in his life. Just when something opened up, he went for it. And the dead end of the League of Devotees and tried something else. And it seemed like it was so clear that Krishna was controlling
the whole. Yeah, Krishna didn't control just at the end, but he controlled each step. It took time to prepare, Prabhupada said. It also impresses us, it's not a cheap thing to become a world acharya and to be potent enough to spread Krishna consciousness everywhere. Even for Prabhupada, it took time. Again, it doesn't mean that he was immature and became mature, but in his own expression, Krishna was getting him ready in every way. So that when he did go, it was like such an explosion in his late age of such potency that everything happened at the perfect time and at a very quick rate. Yes?
How is it that in that poem Srila Prabhupada said that he's unfortunate?
And so, that's just the humility. I don't love Krishna, therefore I'm unfortunate. I'm an insignificant devotee. He wasn't thinking that these people in America, they look very rich, so I feel insignificant compared to them. But the person who comes here to give Krishna consciousness to them, he should be a very powerful devotee, but I'm just insignificant. That Vaishnava humility. He actually was the chosen one, but as we would expect the chosen one to be, he was very humble about it, that it's Krishna through me, it's the Bhagavatam that I may deliver, but it's not me. How different from those who came advertising themselves, like Balaji, Yoga, Yogi, and others, that I am the incarnation, I've come, and I'm a great person. I don't have a spiritual master, I don't refer to books, I am God. Prabhupada said, I'm an insignificant person, beggar. But he was so empowered, so that's a sign of his fortune. All right, we'll stop. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. I'll go over some questions first. And I invite you to send them up, any questions you have about Prabhupada, on pieces of paper for me to handle at the beginning of the classes. Question. I don't have the determination and I'm not empowered as Prabhupada was, but he wants all of us to do as much as he has done. So how should we see this? Should we try to be like Prabhupada? No, I don't think we can imitate Prabhupada. So it's not that we have to try to be like Prabhupada exactly and feel that we're failing. We can't be a Founacharya of ISKCON empowered Shakti Vishavatar. You can't be like Prabhupada, he's too great. But did the squirrel in the Ramchandra Leela, did he try to be like Lord Rama? He didn't try to be like Rama, but he sincerely wanted to help in Rama's mission. So he flicked some sand into the ocean to help build the bridge, and Rama was as satisfied with him as he was with the big monkeys. So we should follow our vows, initiation vows, and don't shame Prabhupada and his movement. Be a good example as a devotee. Always seek some service. So yes, we should do as much as we can according to our capacity. When I ask a devotee how we should meditate on Prabhupada now, he said that Srila Prabhupada's body as we knew it is no more, that he is in his eternal body. I felt disturbed to hear this, as I always think of Prabhupada as he was. Prabhupada dreamt three times of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati as he was, in his tall, scholarly form. So, can we think of Srila Prabhupada as he was? My answer is yes. This is the form of Srila Prabhupada in Chaitanya Leela. It's not an unimportant form. It's the merciful form that we knew. And by thinking and worshipping Prabhupada in this form, then everything will be revealed to us about further forms. An example also is that we think of the six Goswamis, as in that prayer about the six Goswamis. They're described in their sadhaka forms, or as pure devotees, wearing loincloths, chanting Hare Krishna. And by worshipping in that form, then you can understand their Gopi Manjari form. So yes, not that we have to say this form is gone. And there's a similar question by the same person about determination, similar to the first question I had. How Prabhupada was so determined, how to develop that quality. Is it a material quality? But in Prabhupada it became a spiritual quality. Is this the correct way to view the very prominent quality of Prabhupada? Prabhupada was very determined. His determination was to bring the whole world to Krishna consciousness. He said that history will record that these books of mine saved the world from barbarism and it falling into a completely uncivilized state. So he was determined in such an ambitious way. But our determination may be a little smaller, like determined not to overeat, to control our senses, to tolerate our marriage for grihasthas, to stay in ISKCON despite disagreements, to be determined to continue to struggle even though we keep slipping and falling. So we also have to have great determination, as Prabhupada displayed it. Deliberately practice it and pray for it and associate with devotees who have it. Here's one I like. A Mahabhagwat devotee like Prabhupada or Prahlad Maharaj cares very much for the fallen souls and is not concerned for his own salvation. What danger is there for a fallen conditioned soul taking to this same mood? On the surface we might think that there's certainly no danger in taking to this, wanting to save the fallen souls. But I think there is some danger. One danger would be that if we have this attitude to save the fallen souls, but we don't save ourselves. You can't even save yourself. An impure devotee, if he goes out thinking, I'm going to save all the souls, there'll probably be some mixed motive there. He's doing it to satisfy his ego. He wants to be seen as a savior. So the mood that we can best take is to humbly work for the recognized Mahatma who is saving souls, working hard in some small corner of his movement. So there could be a danger in thinking yourself the savior. All right. I have some more, one or two only. Hope I'll get some more from you. Today we're going to talk about Prabhupada struggling alone in New York City in 1965-1966. We already talked about him struggling at many times, but especially in New Delhi in the 1950s when he didn't have money and shifted residence from one place to another. Which was more difficult? They're both difficult. In some ways, New York City was more difficult. It's not his home country. That makes a big difference. To be a very elderly person, not in good health, and have no friends, no connections, no countrymen, made it very difficult. It's one of the most amazing things about Prabhupada's life. We've been studying his life in 10 classes, covering considerable periods of time. Now we're just covering a brief period. And sometimes we've said that Prabhupada's brilliance was a little covered and had to be understood by his meditations while he was a young married man, that I want to serve my spiritual master. But now he's doing something that is amazing by anyone's perception, to come to New York City all alone. And very, very difficult. He barely survived the heart attacks, and he had no money, and a three-month visa. So a question can be raised, I'm going to raise it for you. Why did Krishna put Prabhupada in so much difficulty? Why did he have to struggle so much to spread the Krishna consciousness movement? Do we have some answers? Yes, Korba.
To test his desire first, if his auditors will teach all the difficulties he will present.
Krishna wanted to test his desire. Alright, Sankrishan?
Krishna wanted to glorify his devotee and showing how perseverant he was.
Yes. Otherwise, you might say, well, if Prabhupada, we understand Prabhupada's a liberated person, what's the need of a test? But when he passes the test, then he's glorified, and Krishna is very pleased. See, my devotee underwent this test, and he was successful. Yes.
For his following, because we certainly have to struggle, and if everything was easy to
see. In our struggles, we can turn, say, to Prabhupada, who struggled, and try to not complain. Why else did Prabhupada have to struggle so much in New York City?
It also endears us more to him, makes us feel closer and more grateful to him for having done what
he did. That's nice. I have some Shastric references to why pure devotees are put into difficulties. One is in describing different kind of difficulties and impediments one meets. This is in the section about in the fifth canto, about I forget his name right now. Oh, Priyavrata. That there are two kinds of impediments. One is the desire of the Lord. So this indicates that sometimes the Lord wants to give a devotee impediments, not that it's karma or something. Srimad Bhagavatam, second canto, chapter 8, text 6. Difficulties are gladly suffered by the devotees in preaching, because in such activities, although apparently very severe, the devotees of the Lord feel transcendental pleasure because the Lord is satisfied. Then, Prabhupada lecturing, 1972, he says, if I have surrendered to Krishna, Krishna has taken charge. If I am thinking I am suffering, it is also Krishna's grace. We should take it like that. Even if I'm suffering, we must accept Krishna's grace. All right, I have surrendered to Krishna. If Krishna is giving me suffering, that's all right. Prabhupada said yesterday, Prabhupada said recently, Prabhupada said later in his life, that that year in New York was better than later, because he said, I was all alone, and I only had Krishna to depend on. And I have so many disciples to depend on. So depending on a lot of disciples is harder than just depending on the Supreme Lord. So although it wasn't full of comforts, it was very sweet to always be thinking of Krishna, as he always was, but only Krishna. Don't think, oh, I have surrendered to Krishna, and now Krishna is giving me suffering. Oh, I leave Krishna consciousness. Then another, Srimad Bhagavatam 4:21-47. Like Prahlad Maharaj, all pure devotees of the Lord come to this material world with full compassion to deliver the sinful. They undergo all kinds of tribulations, suffering them with tolerance, because that is another qualification of a Vaishnava who tries to deliver all sinful persons. And there are many more like that. Krishna wants to examine his devotees, how staunch the devotee is, just like the Pandavas. So, we're saying Prabhupada in New York, but first he went to suburbia. He went to Butler, Pennsylvania. Boston, New York City, getting off the boat, he said, I didn't know which way to turn. Should I turn left or should I turn right? No plan or reception or anything, but there was a man from the Traveler's Aid who actually had been posted there by Agarwal to give this Swami some advice where to go to get the bus to Butler, Pennsylvania. So even Prabhupada had, and in a lecture later, Prabhupada was once talking about being disturbed. What does it mean to be disturbed? And he said, just like when I first came to this country, he said, I was a new man. And I was looking how to get the bus to Butler, and I was disturbed. But he had somebody indicated where to get the bus.